Well, good morning and welcome to the first of our Saturday sessions, the last day, official day of Sunstone. I would remind you, however, that the last official event is an interfaith service, worship service, that will happen tomorrow morning beginning at 10 o'clock at the Community of Christ Church. There are the addresses in your program. It's also available at the Community of Christ booth over here. This is section 316, Beyond Faith in the Borderlands. Basically, we'll be looking at the effects of earthworm copulation in early Aztec temple rites. Or something. By now, you're pretty much familiar with the rules, but just as a reminder, please make sure that your cell phone ringer is turned off. Please be respectful and attentive. We're trying to, at Sunstone, we make it a goal to build community that allows many ways for people to express their faith. Our recent tagline is, "There is more than one way to Mormon," and we invite you to help us build a community where all paths are given space to be better understood. What that means is we get to practice feeling challenged. At this conference, you might hear things that you agree with, things that inspire you, things that help you grow. Growth can be experienced in many ways. As you go through the conference and encounter ideas all over the spectrum of belief, we invite you to enjoy empathy as your standard of engagement. We are so pleased you have decided to join us at this conference. We hope you'll enjoy this session and the sessions to come. This session is being recorded and will be available for purchase if you're interested. You can go to the registration desk to do that. Your support helps keeping the Sunstone program running. Invite you also to take a look at the bookstore that is on the south end of the building. There are lots of great things there, and we thank Benchmark Books for coming and helping with that. This is a 60-minute long session. We're asked to make sure that we keep within the framework of that time. When we close the session, we would like to clear this room as quickly as we could. I'm sure that Stephen and Jeff will be available out in the hall if you have a question that you didn't get to ask during the presentation. If you do wish to ask a question, again, I remind you that we're being recorded, so please come up and use the microphone. We're a small number, and it's easy to try to holler it out, but the microphone may not pick it out, and that's important for the recording. So the presentation description, many troubled LDS members dwell in the borderlands of the church. Acceptability is always an issue for borderlanders, but acceptability has two facets. First, what we need to do to be acceptably faithful, and second, what can be done to make borderland members like us more acceptable and better perceived as being faithful. This session will explore these two facets of acceptability and their relationships to being faithful. D. Jeff Burton is the author of For Those Who Wonder and Braving the Borderlands column in Sunstone. Stephen Carter is the director of publications for Sunstone, author of Mormonism for Beginners, editor of Moth and Rust, Mormon Encounters with Death, and the voice of the Sunstone Magazine podcast. And so we will begin our presentation. Jeff, you're going to start us off.
Hi, I'm Jeff Burton. Great to be with you. If you'd like to move a little closer, we might feel like more of a little group here. Kind of a. They like the Borderlands, yeah. You don't have to, but if you can hear me. It's quite an honor to be with Stephen, and I appreciate your coming in to hear us. I'll be talking for about 15 or 20 minutes, and then Stephen will speak, and then we'll take some questions, I guess, and we may be done before an hour's up. I don't know. We'll see. So anyway, let me make my presentation. I've had a little trouble with my eyes, so if I'm looking down, please forgive me. Older statistics generated in and out of the church suggest that sometime during their lives, as many as 80% of those baptized, and in some countries more, worldwide, either leave the faith, become non-participators, or hover in the borderlands of the church trying to be faithful as much as they can. I remember some years ago I was invited to come down and meet with a church statistics group, and they showed me some of their studies, and places like Japan and England and other places were hurting pretty bad. But anyway, okay. Is that better? Okay. You can stay there if you want. Notice that I've used the word faith. Our session's about faith, so I've used it in two contexts here. First, a faith can be a religion, like what faith do you belong with or belong to? And second, having faith implies a willingness to follow and to participate and to be active, even in the presence of complication, doubts, and difficulties. Okay, I'll live by faith, even though I don't really know or even believe that this is all true. You know, lots of people have different reasons for staying faithful, staying active, staying in the borderlands. They have a spouse who believes. Their parents want to, the family, the kids. They love going to church, or they love their friends, or whatever. You know, there's all kinds of reasons for wanting and needing to stay with the church. And I'll be talking mostly about the second definition of faith, the having faith portion of this. During the past 30 years, I've made it my own personal calling to help a small segment, those who sojourn on the edges or on the sidelines or in the borderlands, as we've called it, people like us, perhaps, to continue to think of ourselves as church members and to remain acceptably faithful. You know, it doesn't mean we don't follow every single rule, but we do enough to look like we're being faithful. And so, as Roy mentioned, one of the important factors of being faithful deals with the multiple issues of acceptability. Although we don't always feel acceptable, and there are some members in our wards who may not feel we are acceptable, as you know, it is best for us to reach a point where we think of ourselves as being both faithful and acceptable, but in our own way. So it's kind of chilly in here, isn't it? I've got my, this is the only time I can ever wear my Sunstone shirt, and I've got it over my garment, so this is maybe symbolic of what we're doing here at Sunstone. But anyway, it's a little chilly, sorry about that. Let's start with a little history on who or what are acceptable. I'll talk about what the definition of an acceptable or faithful member is, how it's narrowed, or maybe, how it compares to earlier years of the church. You know, if we look back over a little history, two centuries almost of church history, I believe the answer is yes. I think things have narrowed over the years. And let's look at a few historical facts. You know, I give you the sources for these quotes and so forth if you want later, but way back in the start of the church, Joseph Smith himself said he did not like the concept of a creed where a member must believe or must be asked out of that church. He said, "I want the liberty of believing as I please. It feels good not to be trammeled." Now, this is Joseph Smith. He also said the most prominent difference between Latter-day Saints and others is that Latter-day Saints have no creed, but are ready to believe all true principles that exist. Now, that sounds pretty broad to me. And President Joseph F. Smith, the nephew of Joseph Smith, once taught that members, and I'm quoting him here, are given the largest possible latitudes of their convictions. And if a man rejects a message that I may give to him, but is still moral and believes in the main principles of the gospel, and desires to continue in his membership in the church, he is encouraged to remain. Wow, that appeals to me. Well, that was, you know, more than 100 years ago that he said that, but that's at that time. He also said in another location, members of the church are, am I doing something with it? Sorry about that. I guess I had my book on the keys there. He said, members of the church are not all united on every principle. Every member is entitled to his own opinion and his own views and his own conceptions of right and wrong, so long as they do not come in conflict with the standard principles of the church. As long as a member believes in God and Christ and has a little faith in the church organization, we nurture and aid that person to continue faithfully as a member of the church, though he may not believe everything. Wow. Wouldn't that be good to hear today from today's pulpit, especially during General Conference? Well, things have narrowed, haven't they? So these liberal and early views of acceptability have narrowed, I think. Or they narrowed. They're getting open now. But let's look at another facet of acceptability. There's two coins. Basically, on one side is the question, who gets to decide what is acceptable? On the other side is the question, are we doing our part to be acceptable? So we've got the two things, kind of, you know, what you need to do to be acceptable or what are we doing about it? It's difficult to say exactly how doing our part to be acceptable should be defined. My basic definition looks like this. It kind of follows what Joseph Smith and Joseph F. Smith said. An acceptable Latter-day Saint is a member of the church who has faith in and tries to live Christ's teachings, who believes and has at least a little faith in the church organization, and who espouses truth above all. Again, quoting Joseph F. Smith. So I think what they said sounds good and it works for me, and I think it would work for a lot of people if they knew about it. That's pretty broad. The body of the church today, fortunately, is made up of many, many parts, all important. And this helps us, those of us who dwell in the borderlands. But as you know, some of our brothers and sisters at the ward level obviously still have more strict criteria of acceptability. For example, stuff related to church attendance and activity, your manner of dress, don't wear pants, you know, that kind of thing. Temple work, word of wisdom, obedience, following blindly, gender identification, and so on. So whether we like it or not, sometimes we are judged by these older, more narrow criteria, even today in our rapidly world of expanding acceptability. You know, we're talking about the ward level here. So let's move on. We might ask ourselves a related question. What can be done to broaden these bounds of acceptability? Make them more broad, like Joseph Smith and Joseph F. Smith were talking about. And both of the general and our local areas. That might seem like a strange question, but it is one that has some answers. You know, you remember famous Juanita Brooks. She once wrote that the church is like a huge herd of cattle being driven across the landscape. To jump out in front and try to turn the herd will result in being trampled. It is best to call to the lead cows from the sidelines. Hearing they may turn, but only in small increments at first. Note that she says, from the sidelines. So that's kind of us at the borderlands. We have the right and the responsibility to try to change things. And if we follow Juanita Brooks' advice, we can sometimes do that. And I have, my own experience seems to say that. So when we seem inhibited by general policies, we have the right to try to influence those general policies. For example, if I think that my child needs more instruction on Christ's teachings of honesty, and I perceive that our correlated program doesn't emphasize enough teachings of honesty, I have every right and maybe a responsibility to ask appropriate leaders to include more instruction on honesty in our teachings. And you can do this at the local leadership level or at the general leadership level. The same approach works for almost any concern. If you feel a church needs a policy of greater acceptance of diversity, and we're dealing with that a lot today, then in order to foster tolerance and love at your local level, then by all means, let your feelings be known. Write letters, send emails, and so forth. I can't share the details with you or the specific people I've been in contact with over the years, but I know from personal experience that our leaders read and sometimes respond to our letters written in private concerning things that trouble us. Working through normal channels is always a good idea if it is possible. I have a good relationship with one of the apostles right now, and just because of confidentiality, he doesn't want me to mention who he is. And I've had apostles contact my stake president about things I've written to them, so they get the message back to me, and I've written, that kind of thing. So it does happen. So, you might try it. Few would deny, and talking about changes, few would deny that recent changes in the general church rules related to, children of LGBTQ families that are being baptized, those horrible rules they had for a while, were influenced by local members. Non-members. The church had a lot of information given to it from various sources about that policy. So, it's they've made some changes recently, and we can take part credit of that for that. So, I know from personal experience, for example, looking back many years, the blacks and the priesthood policy and temple ceremony changes that have occurred over the last few decades have been influenced by member comments and complaints. I, like many like me, wrote to the leadership about our concerns, and all these efforts seem to have been to have had positive effects over the years. One more thing on changes. The recent church name change makes it easier for people like us to remain. No longer as Mormons, we can't use Mormons anymore, but as other names like Christians. Think about it. If you think of yourself as a Christian, going to the Mormon church or to the LDS church or whatever they call it now, that makes it easier for us in the borderlands. Let me tell you about an early experience I had. I was about 21 when my bishop called me in and said, "How come you haven't gone on a mission?" I told him, quite frankly, I can't bear testimony related to Joseph Smith being a prophet, the Book of Mormon being authentic history, the church being the only true church, and all so forth. I just don't have a testimony of that, He said, he looked at me and he said, he asked me about my feelings about Jesus and about his teachings and about his ways of living and behaving and Christianity in general. I thought about it a minute, and I thought, yeah, I'm okay with those. And he said, okay, I'll get you a call to Japan, and you convert people to Christianity. And so I did. I went to Japan as a missionary. And over there, my proselyting approach was not going door-to-door or anything like that. My companion and I would look for ways to help non-Christian Japanese people. And then when they tried to repay us, that was kind of the Japanese way of living. It's kind of a reverse eye for an eye, tooth for tooth kind of thing. If you do something, if somebody does something good for you, you need to repay them. It's a philosophy of life in Japan called Giri. But I won't go into it in any depth. But people would say, how can I repay you? And I would say, we're Christians. We believe in doing good for others without any need for repayment. And they'd look kind of, what? And when they look confused, I would say, do you want to hear more about Christianity? We're part of a good Christian group called Mormonism. Come on over and we'll tell you about it. If people wouldn't come to the church and get taught, I didn't bother with them. Well, of course, we had exceptions, but you know, we had so many people interested. And it worked for us, well, my companions and I, because we had 60 baptisms, probably still a record for Japan. Nowadays, if missionaries in Japan get two baptisms, they feel lucky. So I had 60. In one case, a very nice couple heard us out, and they were converted. And then they chose to attend and join a Methodist church instead. And my companion was all upset because they didn't join our church. But I just said, look, we converted somebody to Christianity. That's good enough. And it was. I felt good about it. So that's been my approach to successful living in the borderlands of the church. I think of myself first as a Christian, and second as a member of a great Christian sect, until recently known as Mormonism. So now I'm a Christian who happens to belong to this church. To take it a bit farther, what about being something like, you know, rather than a Christian Mormon, how about being a Buddhist Mormon? Can you do that? Sounds weird, but it worked for some members in Japan. Let me share one story. Some missionaries complained to our mission president that some members were still maintaining and using little Buddha shrines in their houses. Every house has a little Buddha shrine in it. And they were intended to honor their parents, other deceased relatives. And they would say little prayers and offer small sacrifices at the family shrine on special occasions through the year. This really irritated some missionaries. You know, you can't do that. You're a Mormon now. But the president, for some reason, he asked me my opinion on it. And I told him as long as it was not leading to sinful behaviors and they were active LDS, why be too concerned? If they supported the church and attended regularly, couldn't this be part of their personal religions, their personal lives? They're just honoring their ancestors like we do with our genealogy and temple work. What was the harm? That's what I told him. He went away, and you know, I went away, and a few weeks later, the president announced that he was allowing members to keep their shrines. So that, you know, that was one interesting thing. And there were other Japanese things, too, that are kind of unique to their culture, which people wondered if they could fit into Mormonism. And funeral services follow kind of a Shinto ritual where they bring the body into the house and all these kind of funny things. And so people looked askance at that. Oh, that's not the way we do it in the church. But, you know, there is a way, you know, to be a Buddhist Mormon or a Christian Mormon. So if you like something outside the church that is helpful to you and that leads to truth, as Joseph Smith said, and to loving behaviors, You could integrate it into your personal Mormon religion without too much concern. I believe everybody has a personal Mormon religion. Sometimes it's very strict. Other times it's very liberal. Sometimes it'll be part of the gay community or whatever it is. Everybody has kind of a personal slant on their LDS membership. So if you find something that you think will work and it'll be compatible, no problem. One thing I will caution you, though, don't try to convert everybody else to your ways of thinking. This might be something you may have to just kind of have within yourself or within your family. So let's get back to church policies and their impact on this. Like politics, church programs and policies are mostly local in their impact. But conversely, local activities and efforts, like at the ward level, have the potential for influencing the general leadership, too. As we've seen recently with this LGBTQ thing and baptism and stuff and so forth. So it's helpful for us to try to also influence local members and leaders as they attempt to follow what may seem to be imprecise and inconsistent policies, local traditions, and personal attitudes and biases. Most importantly for us, we want local people to avoid unloving actions that create suffering and that tend to narrow acceptance and breed intolerance. Here's a few thoughts for expanding acceptance at your ward and branch levels. Stay involved with the church. Little can be accomplished by those outside the church. Concerned, faithful members can change things for the better at the local level and eventually, if appropriate, at the general level. Let your local leaders and ward members tactfully and lovingly know of your feelings and concerns. Don't hold them in if you unless you just absolutely need to. Speak out as appropriate. It is best to be polite, loving, and Christ-like in your comments and suggestions, of course. Be careful not to hurt or embarrass anyone. And if only one person in every ward stood up for increased tolerance and acceptance of diversity and the search for Joseph Smith's all true principles, it would have a worldwide impact for good, I think. The next thing is, give time to your concerns. Things will likely correct themselves because the church is led by well-meaning leaders. It may take some years sometimes, but eventually, right will prevail. And who knows, sometimes we may be wrong. You know, there's been times when I've been wrong about things, and at a stake president or somebody pointed out to me, and he's right, I shouldn't be going down this road. And time is a good friend, a teacher for us, so be patient. Work through change through regular and appropriate channels where possible. Support truth. Work and pray to understand the issues, then tactfully and humbly share what you know with others as warranted and appropriate. Be honest with yourselves and others in all communications. That's important. Be careful not to hurt others by your actions. You know, sometimes it's best to be in the closet about some things because it might hurt your wife or her husband or children or something. As a closing summary, I think it's useful to be active in our roles as faithful and acceptable borderlanders. So that's my presentation. Thanks. I guess we'll take your questions and so forth later. Oh, one more quick thing. I've got a few copies of my book for those who wonder who would like to have a copy, or they have them down at Benchmark Books, for example. And if you want to, it's available for a free download from my website. It's called forthosewhowonder.com. And all the Borderland columns, all 63 columns of the Borderlands are on there too, and you can just download if you want to go back and look some issue. You can see something in the older columns that you might want to see. I've been doing those columns since 2002. So anyway, forthosewhowonder.com if you want to go get this stuff.
This is the newly announced Indianapolis Temple. How do you like it? I'm kidding. Okay, now I can stand up straight. Sweet. Okay, from my own experience, when you're in the borderlands, you run into a lot of frustrating situations. You often feel like an outsider, like you're not really wanted. You seem to think in a different language from the Mormons around you, which is strange because you remember what it's like to speak in their language. In fact, you can still speak it. So I've been in the borderlands for about 20 years now, and I've started to see my interaction with the church through a new metaphor. Religion is a technology. And I think it reveals some very important things about our role as borderlanders. In fact, it might turn out that we're essential. This idea started percolating in my head while my brother and I toured the George Washington Masonic National Memorial. We gawked at the vaulted ceilings. You can see them there. We gawked at the vaulted ceilings, the towering stained glass windows, and the heroic sized statues. And a lot of them depicted figures I recognized from my high school classes on the Revolutionary War. But these depictions were different. In high school, I saw George Washington either in army regalia or dressed to the nines as president of the new country. But in these depictions, bing, he was wearing pieces of ceremonial garb, a sash, an apron, and he was carrying a trowel. The other people had similar garb on, and the mural showed them staged ceremoniously in a church, in a public square, etc. So the more I looked through this building, the more it struck me as looking like a religious edifice. The thing was, even though everything out there in here looked religious, the tour guide and the various exhibits took pains to point out that Masonry was not a religion, even though you had to believe in God to join it. It was a brotherhood, an organization. So the exhibits started connecting this organization. Oh, there's some of the stained glass windows. You can see how religious it looks, and yet if you look closer, there's a lot of secular stuff going on in there, like Benjamin Franklin. And then here's a replica of an early lodge room. And you can see that it feels sacred and ceremonial, but at the same time, no Jesus pictures, etc. So, where are we at? The exhibit started me connecting this organization, so full of religious-looking stuff, but so insistently not a religion, with the founding fathers, who were a bunch of smart, usually wealthy, motivated guys who were trying to forge a new country. And from what I could see in this memorial, Masonry was a big part of their lives. After the tour, I started talking with one of the head honchos of the memorial, who, upon hearing that we were from Utah, with the symbol of the bee, gave us a compelling new view, new to me, into the symbol of the honeybee. He said that, like worker bees, Masons go out into the world and gather knowledge, which they bring back to the hive in order to make honey together. So when his particular lodge gets together, that's what they do. They bring knowledge from their disparate walks of life and make something of it together. And suddenly it all clicked. I saw Masonry as a technology. Its function is to facilitate synthesis. I saw all of these pieces of clothing and accessories, all these ceremonies, all these meetings and handshakes and code words as pieces of a technology, specifically designed to facilitate the sharing of knowledge and to provide a structure that synthesized new ideas from that knowledge. So it may seem strange to call Masonry a technology, since we're also used to thinking of technology as having a physical manifestation, like a book or writing or a computer. But I actually think it's a very useful metaphor. This social technology can plug people in together, like nodes, to facilitate their communication and to help them do complex things that they wouldn't be able to do alone. So Masonry provided a set of passcodes that let two people meeting for the first time know that the other had learned a specialized language and symbol set that they could communicate through, and that they could trust each other, and that they shared similar values. So instead of having to build such a language and conversation environment up from scratch, it could be created on the spot with just a handshake. So if we view Masonry as a technology, we can see other things as technologies, such as monogamy, polygamy, military, democracy, and patriarchy. And, as we might intuit, each of these technologies is designed to do something different. Monogamy is a production technology, bringing two people together to perform designated roles that produce both goods and socially integrated children. Polygamy is the same, except that the abstract roles, such as leadership and authority, usually devolve to the men. And the physical roles, such as food production and childcare, usually devolve to the women. Patriarchy is an efficiency technology. It assigns roles and responsibilities based on one's body parts. Military is a focusing technology. It assigns unambiguous roles and chains of command, and democracy is a social investment technology. It opens government roles to the citizenry and thus invests the average citizen into the government. And then, of course, there's religion, the reason we're here, which is an identity construction and maintenance technology. So Mormonism is an especially interesting religion to talk about in this context, since Joseph Smith was so influenced by Masonry. He was a synthetic thinker, constantly bringing disparate ideas together and making something out of them. And then Brigham Young took Joseph's technology and made it into a hybrid with military, patriarchal, monogamous, and polygamous technology, assembling a well-functioning organization that brought people together, provided a chain of command, and, with a hefty dose of Smith's theology, created a language to imbue it all with cosmic purpose. And when you compare the success rate of Mormons over other frontier settlers in the American West, you can see that technology is actually a great word for what the Mormons had. With it, they were much more likely to not only survive, but thrive. And you can tell how that basic technology has carried over to today. that mix of technologies produces, on the whole, successful people. Plug Mormonism into a person, and they are likely to become a healthier, more socially integrated, and more financially successful. So, what does Salt Lake Mormonism's technology look like in its most basic form? I'm going to show you. Come on. I see it as a rolling circle. Segment one, God is an advanced human, and we can become advanced humans too. Which pushes segment two. Don't do it. Oh, it did it. All right. Segment two, we can only become advanced humans if we all do it together. Which pushes segment three. Church leaders know the best way to lead us all toward becoming advanced humans, which pushes segment four. If you put enough work into it, you will be successful at anything a leader asks you to do. So, segment one provides the metaphysical motivation, the reason we do anything. Segment two creates the cohesive community to do something in. Segment three focuses the energy of that community. And segment four maximizes individual contribution to the community and invests the individual into segment one. And it's a great big eternal round. So certainly there are numerous complexities, but that's the basic structure. And it's a very effective technology. It covers everything from the why to the what to the how. And it's seamless. I'm pretty sure most of us in this room remember what it's like to harness the Mormon technology in our own lives. I certainly do. However, this is the Borderlands session. So even though we remember how the Mormon technology worked in our lives, providing not just temporal but spiritual benefits, we've distanced ourselves from it in some way. Which sounds crazy. Why would you disconnect from a piece of technology that has so many benefits? I'm going to stick with our metaphor. I want to suggest that it is because the technology broke down in some way. The story I hear most about where the technology broke down takes place in the third segment. Church leaders are supposed to know how best to lead us toward becoming advanced human beings. But if you study history at all, they do things that call their own advanced state into question. There's plenty of room for forgiveness within the conventions of middle-class morality, when we hear them making the same mistakes that we make sometimes. But when they do the kinds of things that would get us excommunicated or thrown in jail, it's difficult to continue looking up to them. However, if segment three breaks down, it seems like we might want to still stick with the technology anyway because it provides such great benefits in segment two, where we're part of a community. But if we find ourselves ejected from the community, for example, if we're somewhere on the LGBT spectrum, or if we love someone who is, then we begin to see that the LDS definition of community has a very hard time including us. The community and its leaders may also even take steps to excise us and campaign against us politically. So if those two segments break, maintaining segment four is almost impossible. You have little faith in your leaders, and you have a difficult time connecting with the community. So you have little incentive to invest personally. Of course, segment four can break down all by itself if its promises of success don't pan out. For example, I've heard many stories about gay men going on a mission to cure their homosexuality, only to come home with the same orientation they'd gone out with. But sometimes it'll break down just because you start to count the cost of segment four and wonder what aspects of your family and your physical, mental, emotional, and physical well-being get sacrificed when you, with your efforts to fulfill all the dictates of your leaders. And sometimes the breaking of one segment leads to the breaking of the others, until the only thing you have left is segment one, you and God. The interesting thing is, the Mormon technology wraps God so tightly into segments 2, 3, and 4 that ex-Mormons often toss segment 1 too. So I'm suggesting that we look at Mormonism as a technology that's designed to do something specific with specific materials. This helps some of the things that frustrate this, you know, This helps some of the things that frustrate us about Salt Lake's Mormonism make more sense. So the church does benefit from the efficiency of patriarchal technology. So of course it resists giving women authority. It benefits from the power focus of military technology. So of course it has a hard time taking the concerns of low-level individuals seriously. It benefits from the material and familial production of monogamy. So of course it has a hard time accommodating any other marriage types. On the other hand, we can also see why polygamy became such an important part of early Salt Lake Mormonism, since it did such a good job at further boosting patriarchy technology and shifting the burden of material production and family rearing to females. I actually think the plan of salvation is better termed the plan of productivity, because that's what Mormonism makes. Producers. And that's not a bad thing. I recently did some freelance work on a book about a group that gives business training to Mormons in third world countries, and it was really interesting to see how blurry the line between the gospel and business strategies was. But it also measurably improved the quality of these people's lives. So if Salt Lake Mormonism started tweaking its technology, it would start to produce different kinds of people, embedded in different kinds of power structures. For example, the Unitarian Universalists have consciously dismantled patriarchy and military technology in their organization. And this has led to a diffusion of power and a more lateral leadership structure. It's become more democratic, which is a technology for investing people in their own governance. However, along with the democratic technology has come a lessening of political power. The Unitarians are not known for getting organized, gathering wealth, or carrying out complicated initiatives. But they're great at integrating a wide range of people into their congregations. Unitarian Universalism is a much different technology than Salt Lake Mormonism is. They produce different kinds of people and different kinds of results. I actually presented this idea of religion as a technology to a Unitarian minister, and he speculated that if that was the case, Jesus was anti-technology. And at first I didn't know what he meant, but then it started clicking. The first thing that jumped out at me was when he said, "Man was not made for the Sabbath, but the Sabbath for man." Jesus was calling the Sabbath a technology. And then I noticed him telling us how to break various technologies. For example, military technology. If anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with him 2 miles. How to break the social technology. Love your enemies. Pray for those who persecute you. How to break the political technology. When you're invited to a feast, take the lowest place. So Jesus was playing havoc with various social technologies by eating with tax collectors, hanging out with prostitutes and lepers, and advocating for the marginalized. However, it doesn't look as though Jesus was trying to burn any particular technology to the ground. He was just throwing monkey wrenches in here and there. Either that, or he was just a terrible political organizer. Is there a pattern to his sabotages? It seems to me that he targeted the times and the circumstances when a single person was being ground under by the workings of Judaic or Roman technology. The many had the technology on their side, but the one needed saving from that technology. The funny thing is, this mischievous Jesus, this social saboteur, gets completely erased in the Doctrine and Covenants. So instead of the guy who critiques the system, he's the guy who's telling Joseph Smith how to make the system. And Jesus gets turned into a technologist, a builder of systems. It makes him into an administrator instead of a revolutionary, which is what the Mormon technology does. So we borderlanders are in a very interesting spot. We know what it's like to be hooked up to a powerful and effective technology, and we also know what it's like to be hurt by that technology. We also know what it's like to start disengaging from it. Though we lose the particular forward momentum and focus of Orthodox Mormonism, we get to watch ourselves becoming different people, depending on what kind of technology we hook ourselves up to. For example, I noticed that I was a much friendlier driver after going to UU meetings than I was after going to LDS meetings. I'm still not sure why that is. We find out how much our technology runs us. But as I pointed out, one or more pieces of the Mormon technology broke down for probably everybody in this room. No one dumps their technology because it's imperfect. They dump it because it doesn't do what we need it to do. So the Mormon technology works for a whole bunch of people. We remember what it's like to be one of them. But now it's more complicated for us. So what is our role as Borderlanders? I want to turn to an unlikely source for the answer to that question. The Book of Mormon. Its main theme, at least as it was taught to me as in seminary, was the pride cycle. The people are badly off, so they remember God. God blesses them with prosperity. Don't turn off. Oh my gosh. And the people become warlike and forget the marginalized. So their riches disappear through war, famine, etc., until they remember God again. You all remember that. So we can see, in my opinion, everything the Book of Mormon warned us of happening in the places where the church is successful. An increase in wealth, followed by an increase of being warlike and forgetting the marginalized. Which presidential candidate carried the most Mormon of states? A warlike man who despises and officially persecutes marginalized communities. The church is singularly ill-equipped to reach out to and is often antagonistic toward marginalized communities unless they're willing to become a part of the Mormon technology. But the Book of Mormon tells us that this kind of technology, the kind that was built to gather power, becomes warlike every time and forgets the marginalized, soon losing not just its riches, but its soul. So, perhaps Borderlanders are the sand in the gears of the pride cycle, slowing it down, and hopefully stopping it in the right place where we're rich, right? But how do we do that? We follow Jesus' methods of sabotage, of course. If you look at how Jesus structured his critiques, you'll see something very interesting. The normal functioning of technology is to gather power. The Salt Lake Church is a very successful example of that. Jesus, on the other hand, dispersed power. He found the people who didn't have power, and he shared what he had with them. It's an interesting strategy because it goes against our normal way of advocating for our particular version of justice. Our usual method is to build our arguments to show that we are right and that our opponent is wrong. To prove that our critique is valid, we position ourselves to come out on top. Jesus, on the other hand, positioned himself to come out on bottom. Did he come out on top socially when he got the women caught in adultery off the hook? No. He was despised for it. Did he come out on top when he healed the son of a centurion? No. His community hated him for it. Did he come out on top when he associated with tax collectors, lepers, and prostitutes? And his final act, the crucifixion, if we're going to believe Paul's interpretation, was the same thing. He sacrificed himself, allowing himself to be put in the one-down position by both Jews and Romans in order to disperse his power to sinful humanity. So even though Jesus was right, he executed his critiques so that he always came out on bottom. That sacrifice was what gave his critiques authority. If your critiques gather power to yourself, you're just part of the technology. So it seems that the Borderlanders are in a unique position in that we know what it's like to be both inside and outside of a technology. When we look at back at our Orthodox days, we realize that we couldn't see outside of it then, but now we can. We have a view of how Mormonism functions. Perhaps the Borderlanders' unique calling is to disperse power at our own expense, to lose, to take the one down position, so that we can share power with those who need it. The speakers in General Conference often talk about ward leaders going after lost sheep, but it seems to me that the ward leaders are often the least equipped to do so. Bishops were originally described as judges in Israel, and the first bishop was mainly in charge of distributing physical resources. And I think that judge and administrator are great words for what bishops do. Often they've never seen outside the Mormon technology, but they work very well within it. So they can't empathize with the lost sheep, the people who are ground under by the Mormon technology. But we can see it. How do we go about doing this, though? What are the tactics that can help us actually put this action into our wards? I have a few simple possibilities. First, express unconditional love at awkward times. You and I can think of many times when we felt condemned by a comment in class or felt ground down by a lesson. Having someone come to our defense or express love toward us would have made a huge difference. And sometimes we'll spend hours thinking about the argument we should have had ready for the occasion. But I think that expressing love is a better tactic than engaging in debate, because otherwise you get in a fight with the technology. And the technology is huge. For example, if somebody is disparaging someone in the LGBT community, they do have a lot of LDS precedent backing them up. And all you have is a minute or two to mount a counter-argument, which will do very little against such a huge current. However, if you say something like, "If anyone here is part of the LGBT community, I just want to let you know that you're welcome to sit next to me in church. I'd love to have your company. To me, you're just fine the way you are." Then you've avoided the labyrinthine arguments, and you've made space in the room for someone to be themselves without judgment. At the same time, you've taken the one down position. Some people may now hesitate to sit next to you in the future, wondering how they might be perceived. But that's okay, because the spot next to you is reserved for someone who needs it, even if they never actually use it. They know it's there, and that's a comfort in itself. By going the unconditional love route, you're not borrowing power from the technology. You're tapping into your own personal power and into the power of God, who has often been described as love. Except that your power doesn't look like power at all in the technological context. Jesus even admitted that his power was not of this world. I have like 6 minutes left, huh? I'm almost there. Second, broadcast your... I'm going to skip that one. Third, repent in public. From what I've seen, the LDS Church is really bad at repenting, and that affects us as a people. For example, it was interesting to see how M. Russell Ballard disavowed the church's practice of pushing investigators into baptism, distancing the church from a practice that had become unpopular without actually acknowledging the church's complicity in it. Basically, he said, "I'm not sure how those decades of missionaries and mission presidents could possibly have misinterpreted us." He implied, do you remember this? Okay. He implied that the church had always had a reasonable ethical policy, and it was its adherence that had messed up. But this method helped the church technology retain its power. So from my experience, Mormons do something similar. They talk about their shortcomings. If they talk about their shortcomings at all, it's always to show how they found a better way and performed the Mormon technology better now, thus gathering power. So our job isn't to tell the church or its members how to repent. It's just to show them that it can be done without blowing up. I've seen public repentance happen a few times at a pulpit, though never at an LDS pulpit. The first time was at one of my meetings at the Unitarian congregation I attend to supplement my LDS ward. At the beginning of the service, someone got up and said, I'm going to skip that one, actually. The second time was when the pastor was talking about two different ways to approach Jesus, as a divinity and as a wise man. And as he went through his descriptions, it was pretty obvious which approach he preferred. But suddenly he stopped and he said, "I just realized that most people who approach Jesus as a divinity would think, I haven't done a very good job at articulating their beliefs. I really should have done a better job. If you're one of those people, I'd really love to talk to you after the service so that I can understand you better. Please accept my apology." So in each instance, the speaker, suddenly hearing what they were saying through different ears, gave up their podium power and acknowledged the legitimacy of those in the room who weren't benefiting from or who were even being actively alienated by the technology they were pushing. But it's a moment of vulnerability. You're suddenly not in charge anymore. You're opening yourself up to judgment. and the rhetorical power of your sermon usually takes a hit. So the two most important things to come out of repenting publicly are, one, to help people see that it can be done without blowing up, and two, to help them feel what happens when someone repents right in front of them. It's a tiny but potent story that plays out in that moment. Someone has power. They realize how that power is affecting someone with less power, and they abdicate that power to them. It's not something you see too often, since usually riding the technology is way more fun. So I guess the main question to ask yourself before performing something you hope is Christ-like sabotage is, am I doing this to gather power for my preferred technology, or am I truly abdicating some of my power in order to give it to someone who has less than I do? And the way that you can tell is if you come out on bottom. You give up some social cachet, some social standing, right at that moment through your act. And why should you do this? Simply because it helps one person, one lost sheep, which is exactly what Jesus asked us to do. 2 minutes left.
We have time for perhaps one question. So if somebody has a question they would like to ask, come on up, use the mic, and on your way up, I would like to thank Steve and Jeff. Well, Steve, I'm a practicing Freemason, and so thank you for giving us the plug.
Oh, sure, yeah. It was a great experience. Yeah.
Does anyone have a question?
So what brought you to thinking about technology for this? I mean, what was the impetus for this? Because I've never heard that before, and it was great. It was a great context for me.
Yeah, it was totally the Masons. It all came together. I mean, I have a bit of a background in anthropology, so I can look at cultures, and also the sociology of knowledge is one of my favorite topics. So those two things probably had a background, but it was totally the Masons who just, bling, it happened in 2 hours.
Questions? If you'd like to have a petition to join, I could talk to you about that after we leave. Any other questions? Going once, going twice. Thank you for being here. I think it's been a great presentation.